Booney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, marine scientist Ken Whelan tells us to forget all we've read about the Sargasso Sea being the only place on Earth where eels spawn. There's a new theory on the block. We hear from the Icelandic linguist who says that some people carry a mutation in a particular gene that makes the smell of rotting fish less intense. And Terry Flanagan gets up close and personal with Ireland's only spiny mammal.
Come on into the back garden here, Terry. I have something to show you.
My God, this is a fine, big, mature garden you have here, John.
Yeah, well, I look after it well. I'm a farmer's son, so I'm used to tilling the soil, and I have nice flowers and all. But I have something very unusual I came across during the summer here, Terry.
Go on, tell us.
You wouldn't believe it. A hedgehog has been coming into my garden during the summer. Now, I haven't seen a hedgehog, I'd say, in the last 40 or 50 years. We had one in our garden at home in Kinnegad years ago, but I haven't seen one in Dublin since.
So, a very busy programme ahead of us, as always. Shortly, we'll be joined by Dr. Richard Collins, who's cocooning at home in Malahide, and Professor Ken Whelan, our marine scientist. He's at home in Rathgar in Dublin. But I want to start with Niall Hatch, who's in studio with me now today. Niall, you've handed me some very interesting stories. Let's start with the first one, and the most shocking of all the stories I've seen in a long time, and it has to do with the social insects, and in particular, a wasp. An aggressive wasp which attacked a bird on its nest and bit its head off and consumed the aforementioned head. Tell me more.
Yes, it's a very gruesome story and accompanied by an even more gruesome video in many of the online journals that have covered this. It didn't take place in Ireland, I'm pleased to say. It was in Brazil.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yes, and so it's not a species of wasp or indeed bird that we have to worry about here in Ireland. But it's been known for a long time that many species of wasp would feed on insects and other invertebrates. They also will feed on dead creatures, they'll eat dead flesh sometimes. But there has never been recorded case of them actually deliberately killing a vertebrate to eat it. So a vertebrate would include mammals and birds and fish and amphibians and reptiles and creatures like that. Now, the bird in question is a very small finch-like bird called a lined seed eater. This is a group of seed-eating birds, as the name would suggest, that you find in South America. And they're quite small, so smaller than a typical finch would be in Ireland. And so obviously, therefore, their chicks are even smaller.
And a stocky bill.
That's right. If you look at the beak of a sparrow, for example, that's one of those conical bills for crushing seeds. So that's very much what these seed eaters look like, and the adults, a lot of them are very brightly patterned. This species, the adult is black and white, but the chicks are little naked, blind, helpless in the nest. So that's what they look like. Scientists in this part of Brazil had been tracking some of these nests, and they found that there was a very high mortality rate among these young birds, and they found that many of them were in the nest with very severe head injuries. And they didn't know what was causing this. So they put some cameras on some of the nests and were horrified to see what was happening was a large type of wasp, sort of a yellow and slightly reddish wasp, was coming into the nest. It was deliberately picking on these chicks and biting chunks out of their heads. And so it was, unfortunately, it was essentially eating their heads while the birds were still alive. It was a really, really unpleasant situation. They don't know why it started doing this. It hadn't been recorded before. One of the theories is perhaps that because there were some other dead chicks in the area around the nest, that the smell of the decomposing little carcasses in these chicks attracted in this carrion-eating wasp. Then it decided, well, I should try some fresh meat as well. So it really makes a very gruesome viewing, but it does show how some of these creatures can be very adaptable and how nature can be extremely harsh. You know, these chicks, as soon as their parents are leaving the nest, this wasp was watching out and coming straight in and grabbing them.
Now, I haven't seen the video yet. I kind of don't want to be honest with you. How large is the wasp in relation to the bird?
It's almost the same size as the little bird. The little chick itself wouldn't be much bigger than your thumb or the top portion of your thumb. It's a small little bird, not long out of the egg. The size comparison between the little bird and the wasp, you know, they're pretty similar. So obviously wasps have these huge pincer-like jaws. Many types of wasps can chew through wood, for example. So we're talking very strong, very sharp jaws. And yeah, it's an unpleasant video. You literally see it tearing chunks of meat off.
Is this the kind of story we should be bringing to our listeners?
Well, I think it's good to look at the natural world in all of its different facets, for good and bad, for the beautiful and the ugly. This is all part of nature, of course.
Yeah, but you're a bird guy. You must now hate wasps.
No, I see this as part of a natural cycle. No, it's very, very interesting. The wasp doesn't intend any malice. It's just feeding itself.
Yes, it does. It wants to kill the bird and eat it.
But the other way, well, it's not malicious, though. You know, it's not doing it out of any badness.
How more malicious can you get?
There's probably no thought even going into it. It's just responding to stimuli. It wants to eat. And the whole, you know, we eat as well. We eat lots of other creatures, too. So that's the way it works. So it's not intending to be evil or nasty or anything like that. And of course, as well, this is how evolution happens. If this becomes a problem in this area of Brazil, the lined seed eaters, this species, the parents who are more attentive at the nest will therefore be more successful. They'll pass on more of their genes, and this attentive behaviour will hopefully then spread the population.
Survival of the fittest.
Precisely, because we know that the wasps don't do this when the parent birds are there. They're very big and much bigger and more active, and they can scare them away. But they only do it when the parents leave. So, yeah, survival of the fittest, as you said.
Okay, let's look at something a little bit happier. Bar-tailed godwit breaks record for non-stop flight.
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. The bar-tailed godwit is a bird that we do get here in Ireland. It's a migrant that comes to spend the winter with us here. It's one of the wading birds. It's actually relatively closely related to the curlew. It has long legs and a long beak, but unlike the curlew's beak, it doesn't curve downwards. It's very, very straight. Mm. And it's known to be a long-distance migrant. The ones that we get here in the winter in Ireland, they tend to come from northern Europe and perhaps even from northern Russia. So they come that distance. But there are other populations all across Asia and indeed into North America. They do breed also in Alaska. Now, if you're a godwit that's breeding in Scandinavia and you migrate down to Ireland, it's not that far distance, really. It would be a long distance for a human to travel, but the birds, they can do that quite easily. They can stop off on the way. If you're a godwit that's breeding in Alaska, there isn't much land to the south of you until you get to New Zealand. So what they do is they migrate from Alaska to New Zealand, and they do that in one non-stop flight. So they've been putting various trackers on these birds, and this record-breaking bird did something quite extraordinary. It went from Alaska to New Zealand. It was a distance of about 12,200 kilometres. It did that in
one way.
It did that in 11 days. So that's more than 1,000 kilometres per day.
Flap, 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 flap,
flap, flap, flap.
Didn't stop to feed?
Didn't stop to feed. There's literally no land.
Did it poo on the wing?
Well, that's a very good question. Probably not, because what they do to be able to make that journey, they actually, all their internal organs atrophy. Their digestive system collapses and becomes much smaller. Their sexual reproductive organs almost disappear. Their intestines shrink up. They absorb all the energy from those to keep themselves going. They burn up their energy reserves, and then they have to start burning protein. So they actually start to consume their own internal organs to make that journey, because there's literally nowhere for them to stop.
It must take a while for them to recover.
Oh, it does. It does. So when they get to New Zealand, the very first thing they have to do is sort of switch their internal workings back on and start gorging themselves on food.
Do they gorge? I was going to say, do they not eat very slowly? Because, you know, if you take a bashing and you're very ill, you can't eat quickly. Everything is done very gently and at a pace, you know, until you're back up to form again.
With the godwits, it's different, because they've evolved over millions of years to use this as a strategy. So by the time they reach New Zealand, they're almost on the brink of death. They might look physically quite normal from the outside, but they've pushed their body to the absolute limit that it can endure. No other bird in the world can fly so far without feeding. So the longest distance migrant bird in the world is the Arctic tern, but it's a seabird. It has the advantage of being able to catch fish en route. The godwits can't do that. They make their living by finding food by wading in shallow water. They can't feed on the open ocean. There's literally nowhere from between Alaska and New Zealand.
So can we be absolutely sure of that, that there's been radio trackers put on these birds?
Absolutely.
So they're not landing?
They're absolutely not landing. They know
11 days. That is extraordinary.
Yeah. So if you just think the endurance that takes to be able to go at their full speed across the open ocean, presumably encountering very bad weather on the way, must be very cold. They're flying day and night. They're not stopping. For 11 days, they do the whole journey. And then, of course, after the winter season is over in the Northern Hemisphere, they have to then fly all the way back to get up to Alaska again. So they do it twice a year. It's really amazing that these birds can survive it. And so it's really fantastic. They've been able to prove that they actually categorically can fly that distance without stopping and do it so quickly.
Do you know what I think about that, Niall?
What's that?
Fantastic. How's your Birdwatch Ireland shop doing? Are you doing lots of business online? Are you going to be challenging Amazon soon for the top space?
I don't know if anyone could challenge Amazon. They do pose threats to a lot of online retailers. But of course, with the COVID situation, the Birdwatch Ireland shop, which is an important earner for us as a conservation charity, we've had to close that to the public. We haven't been able to reopen that yet. So most of our business is now online on our website, and we've got lots of traffic there. Obviously concerned future COVID lockdowns, restrictions may limit our ability to keep that service going. And for a charity like us, that makes
a
big difference.
You depend on it, I know.
We really do. We've heard the stories from lots of charities. The last few months for charities in Ireland have been catastrophic. It's really, really difficult. And Birdwatch Ireland's no different. We've seen our funding absolutely decimated. And it's a fact of life in a way. But, you know, for conservation, we really do need to find a way to continue. So we really are looking for support.
And as you say, you're not alone. So look, I suppose if you're listening to this programme, if you have an interest in natural history and conserving wildlife, then perhaps you might consider your preferred NGO this Christmas. We'll be doing a special programme on the 7th of December, A Mooney Goes Wild, as we do every year, Christmas Wildlife Gifts Special. So look out for that. Now let's talk to Richard Collins and to Ken Whelan. Richard's in Malahide. Richard?
Hello, Derek. Yes.
And Ken Whelan is in Rathgar.
That's right, Derek. Lovely to be back on with you.
Now, Ken, we haven't seen you for an awful long time. It feels like months and months. Where have you been? What have you been doing? Why haven't you been in here?
Oh, I'm delighted at this point to be catching my breath. Because of the situation we found ourselves in, there wasn't a huge amount we could do by way of field work and so on earlier on in the year. So certainly since around May time, I've been really, really busy. Myself and my colleagues from UCD, we've been doing something absolutely disgusting. We've been going around the place collecting all sorts of different samples of bird poo to carry out a big study in terms of looking at predatory birds. I've also been very, very busy with all sorts of community groups around the country that I've been teaching how to look after their rivers and their streams and their lochs. And I've been really taken by the enthusiasm and the interest that's out there at the moment in terms of the environment and in terms of looking after their little piece of the environment.
Well, let's go back to the bird poo and the predatory birds. Explain, Ken.
The Atlantic Salmon Trust that I work part-time for, they have funded a big programme to learn more about the ecology of salmon and trout-eating birds. So we're looking at heron, we're looking at cormorants, and also, because a lot of the work is based in Scotland, we're looking at goosander and red-breasted mergansers, which are expanding at quite a rate in parts of Scotland. Based on, I think I mentioned it before on the programme, some very clever technology that's being developed in UCD. We used it before to look at bycatch in big pelagic vessels to see whether or not they were catching salmon by accident. We turned our attention then to the scat or the poo from these birds to see could we actually see what they were feeding on and to look at the relative proportions of the different types of food. So, for example, if they were feeding on little minnow and they were feeding on sticklebacks, feeding on some trout, did these components of the diet, did they increase in terms of increased numbers of salmon or trout around the time when the young salmon and trout go to sea, the smolt time in May? So we're just starting the programme now and getting a lot of baseline information. But the great thing is that all the indications are that not alone will we be able to look at what is happening in terms of the feeding of these birds. We may very well be actually able to identify individual birds because as they scat, as they release poo, they do release as well some epithelium, some cells from the gut lining and so on, which have obviously got a genetic imprint for that individual bird. So it's really interesting from a behavioural point of view to know whether or not it's individual birds that are feeding heavily on these smolts or whether it's actually the colony that's feeding. So a lot of really interesting stuff to come, but we're very much at the beginning of this and are wide open to advice from our bird experts in terms of how we should go about it and how we should actually plan the collection of these samples.
Ken, that's really interesting research, and I'd be really interested to see what your findings are in due course. But I think that idea of being able to track individuals of each of these species is really unique and really groundbreaking, in fact. But I'm interested in perhaps in a more mundane or prurient matter at the moment. How do you go about collecting the samples? What's involved in that?
That's really what we're doing, is trying to find out exactly how we do this. The first few times that I actually went along the banks of the River Dodder, because it was near to me and it was within my 5 kilometres at lockdown, I was absolutely amazed at the amount of bird droppings that there are when you look closely along a riverbank. So the first thing is to be able to associate the droppings with the individual birds. Now, we can do it with the DNA when we get back to the lab, but it's relatively costly. So you're better off to know where it comes from. So we're putting together, first of all, we're putting together a bank of photographs where we're actually going to try and relate where our field observers actually see individual birds poop and where we know that particular poop is from a particular species. So that's the first thing. The other interesting thing is learning about the behaviour of these creatures. We hadn't realised, but there isn't a huge amount known in any great detail about the behaviour of these particular birds socially and when they're feeding. And again, we're doing something again very novel. We have some colleagues who are interested in using drones for wildlife studies, and we're going to use thermal imaging to look at these creatures as they fly in around dawn. So we can look at the distribution of them and to see how they're actually behaving during the smolt run next May. So we have a twin project. We have the eDNA on one hand and then with the thermal imaging on the other. And again, we're just testing that to see whether or not it disturbs the birds, how high we have to fly, what sort of zones we have to fly. So I think it's a really unusual approach in terms of looking at the behaviour of these animals.
I love the idea of perhaps having a bird poo field guide. That sounds like it'd be a real bestseller, I think, for Christmas.
Well, we have our copyright sign on it already. I think it'd be very interesting to see how that might be marketed. But if you look at what the eDNA people are doing, more and more they're relying on scats, whether it's looking at elephant dung, for example, in Africa, which UCD are very involved with, or indeed looking at seal droppings and so on. It does tell you a huge amount. It's the most disgusting job to have to go and take the sample. But we have developed, or UCD have developed, a really clever way of doing it. So what they use is they use, if you can imagine, like an earbud, but made out of plain wood with a strong cotton top on it. And the cotton top then absorbs in what you need in terms of your sample. And you can break that and put it straight into a tube with silica. And the silica absorbs it then, all the moisture, so it stays for a long time. So there's no messing about with fluids or anything else on the riverbank. And you can actually associate that then with a photograph and you can associate it with a GPS location. So again, that's what we spent the summer doing, was trying to see logistically how we actually do this and how we can be sure that we're collecting information that one piece relates to another.
Ken, you mentioned drones. Now, there was a paper recently, I think last month, in Bird Study, I think it was, very interesting paper, on the use of drones and the extent to which drones disturb birds. I'm afraid the conclusions were a little bit disheartening for the drone community. It found that they do disturb birds, but there were variations. Birds on the coast were heavily disturbed by a drone, whereas ones inland where there were lots of people around were not as much disturbed. So, but the general conclusion of the paper was that drones do not have much of a future in environmental research. But however, it seems to me that as far as birds are concerned, there tends to be two regimes. The breeding season situation, where things like herons or cormorants or something like that are fishing for food for their offspring, and the rest of the year when they are not. So you're likely to get very different results depending on the time of year at which you do this. And if you want poo, I suggest the place to go is to places like heronries or cormorant colonies. You will get the world of poo there and you will know from which species it came. If you're around banks of rivers, it's mainly gulls that are dumping their poo there. So these are just initial thoughts. I might be totally wrong.
You're quite right, Richard, in terms of what you were saying. So that's why we're carrying out the R&D on the drones very carefully. But the idea that we have is to use tethered drones. So the drone will actually be tethered and will be circling in a particular location. And there are some indications that perhaps the birds actually become used to that rather than a situation where it's an unusual noise, it's a background noise. We're just playing around with that at the moment. But certainly in the context of what you say about the observational stuff about the breeding period versus the feeding period, that seems to be absolutely the case. We're able to find quite readily poo from herons. They seem to hammer out a particular section of the river that they're a particular territory that they're really interested in. I hadn't realised how aggressive they were until I saw them dealing with egrets. They can be very aggressive in terms of the area they want to try and lay out. But certainly the heron poo seems to be one particular thing that's a plus. The cormorants, we knew that was probably best to do it on the roosts. The mergansers and gooseanders are fascinating because they do feed very heavily, particularly around the actual time when they're having their young, which is around the time that the smolts are going to see, around May time. So what we're looking at the moment, with the help of some very clever and helpful people from Parks and Wildlife, is perhaps putting mats in place under the roosts of some of the gooseanders and seeing if that's possible. So again, as I say, we at this stage, absolutely, we're at a very early stage. We're just trying to challenge ourselves to try and find ways around these particular features. But as I say, the most interesting thing for me was the fact that there wasn't a textbook where I could lift up this textbook and learn all about the behavior of these particular creatures. And I think that aspect of it, as well as the science in terms of the DNA, that's going to be really unusual and very different, I think, when we pull together the information. We have a team of about 20, I would say, really enthusiastic fisheries officers that we've been meeting online and so on. So they just got their kits this week, and they're on a weekly basis through a WhatsApp group. They're going to report back to us in terms of their experiences, in terms of the behavioural stuff, in terms of what works and what doesn't. So I think overall by spring, we should have a good idea of what we're doing when we go to sample in more detail around the time of the smoltron.
Ken, a new scientific breakthrough regarding eels. Tell me more.
Oh, the eels breakthrough is fascinating. I'm heartbroken, let me be very honest.
Oh dear.
Because the idea of being able to say, well, we know where the eels go. It's definitely the Saragossa Sea. And Johannes Schmidt was correct. This is what we know. And we've talked about this several times on the programme. But interestingly, we've never actually found spawning eels, and we've never found the eggs of eels in the wild. So scientists recently said, well, let's think about this in terms of what we know rather than what we think we know. And there's been some fabulous work done in Europe, and Ireland was very much to the fore in this, in tagging adult eels, what we call silver eels, as they go back into the Atlantic. And these fish headed for the Azores. I mean, that is the long way round if you're going to go to the Saragossa Sea. So the first few fish, the results came back and people said, these are strange eels. Maybe they're not really reflective of what's happening. But then consistently, these eels started to be seen to head for the Azores. So these very clever scientists then started to put together the information they had in terms of the currents, in terms of the movements of the currents, and how these baby eels, because the baby eels really don't swim, they're in the surface layers of the ocean, and they're swept back to the coast of Europe. They're not actually swimming back to their river of origin. They're swept back. How was it that they arrived along the Irish coast? So they then start to look at the Saragossa Sea. Extraordinarily, the Saragossa Sea is actually relatively quiet. So if you look at the Saragossa Sea and you look at the currents coming from the Saragossa Sea, it's very difficult to see how the juvenile eels will make their way back to Europe in any great numbers. Some will, but it seemed then as if maybe there was a smoking gun here. And to cut a very long story short, the scientists then began to look at alternative ideas in terms of how these eels then were going to actually get back to Europe, these young eels. And they came up with the idea that perhaps the eels are actually spawning to the east of the Saragossa Sea. The Saragossa Sea is certainly within this massive great zone that eels may spawn in. But the successful eels may very well predominantly be spawning along this mid-Atlantic ridge. And this is peppered with what we call seamounts. Basically, the eels may be following a volcanic trail of taste or smell. And actually, along this area where the seamounts are, they may actually be mating and releasing some of the eggs and some of the larvae. And this is a revolutionary idea, the idea that it's not all concentrated in the Saragossa, but it is much wider spread. And that theory actually makes sense when you look at both the European eels and the American eels. You can actually map out routes that will bring these baby eels back to America and back to Europe at the right time. So what they're suggesting now, the usual, all scientists suggest this, more research needed. Mm-hmm. So what they're saying is that outside of the areas that traditionally people were looking for juvenile eels, they should now extend them out to the east and try and follow the routes that theoretically their model says that these eels should be found in. I think it's fascinating because it's just so revolutionary in comparison to what was a well-known fact for so many years.
Well, no, Ken, you're saying it was a well-known fact for so many years. Was it not just a theory they came from there? If it was a well-known fact that all these eels went to the Saragossa Sea, then that fact shouldn't have changed. And they've decided to go another way.
Yeah, well, I do. Yeah, no, I chose my words carefully because I was being a little facetious. But the only place we've actually found the juveniles is in the Saragossa Sea. But the thing is, the numbers found and so on are tiny relative to the numbers we know have to come back. So everyone piled in and everybody had a look at the Saragossa Sea and they found these juvenile eels and said, where are the eggs? You know, where's the spawning eels? So in reality, there is obviously some spawning going on there. But the point these guys were making was that if you have this huge mass migration, or at least distribution across the ocean, it has to make sense in terms of the currents. You have to be able to look at a particular point in time and say, right, if they started there at that particular point of the year, this is where they have to be then by spring, because they appear in very early spring into the estuaries and so on, all over Europe and all over Ireland. And it just didn't match. And then they were saying, well, let's stretch this out a bit. Let's look at this particular ridge. And what are they doing going to the Azores? So they think what they're doing is they're aiming for the Azores. They think the Azores is some sort of a point on the map that they can actually aim for as such. And it was interesting that they've also come up with the idea that these small juvenile eels actually imprint a magnetic map on their first movement across the ocean, exactly like birds, that they imprint a magnetic map into their sense of smell, sense of taste, into their brain, into their genes. And they imprint this map and then they basically refollow that back. Mm-hmm. And one of the locations it brings them to in terms of a location that they're aiming for is the Azores. Now, this is all theory at the moment, but I think it sits very comfortable with the information that's there. And it does appear to make more sense in terms of the bulk of the eels.
Now, for all the research that has been done, I just want you to clarify something for me now, Ken. For all the research that has been done, are you telling me that scientists have only seen juveniles in the Saragossa Sea, but they've never seen the eels spawning?
Absolutely. They've never seen the eels spawning.
Now, Ken, as I understand it, the other end of the thing, the larva, he's got to get back to Europe. Now, apparently he depends entirely on the currents to carry him there. Now, you mentioned the American eel, and that the American eel was once thought to be the same species, but it breeds there also. Now, the little babies have the same current carrying them north. How does it come about that some of them are carried, the ones, the American ones, are very conveniently carried to American estuaries, whereas our ones are carried on to Europe? What is the mechanism there?
It's very interesting, because the mechanism, again, this is yet to be conclusively shown, but the mechanism seems to be very similar in terms of the way we get salmon movements in the ocean as well. You have these circular movements in the ocean called gyres. And depending on the location where the particular animal is spawning and the release of the juveniles, the gyre could actually sweep you into a set of currents that would be leading up to the northeast, or indeed the gyre could be leading you northwest or west. So what seems to happen is that you get a separation of the adults. And again, finding the adults and finding the adult spawning is the holy grail. That's what we need to do. And then it will make more sense. But as far as we can see, first of all, we do know genetically that these are actually two very distinct species, which I argued against previously on programmes. But now genetically, they tell us they are two distinct species. So if they are two distinct species, then you're quite right. They have to have a mechanism whereby they're separated out. And the area that I'm talking about, or that the scientists are talking about, is a very large area, this area of potential spawning. So if you can imagine the American eels, in simplistic terms, coming in to the western side of that zone, whereas the European eels are mainly concentrated on the eastern side of the zone, at least for argument's sake, you could say, well, perhaps the big concentration of American eels then are in a location where they will be swept perhaps north initially and then heading west, whereas our eels north initially and then heading east. That's exactly what these very clever guys are recommending, is that the research be done to try and elucidate these particular pathways.
Now, Ken, do you have a good sense of smell?
I think I have a good sense of smell, yeah.
Do you like the smell of fish? I know you do a lot of angling and you're a marine scientist and you're always talking about fish. Do you like the smell of fish?
I have no problem whatsoever with the smell of fish. And yet, you know, I have friends and family that, like yourself, really find it just obnoxious. But I really don't have any issue with it. And certainly I can pick up the bad smell of fish and then I won't like it, obviously. But the ordinary standard smell of fish, I mean, it just doesn't bother me, thank goodness, because I'm often surrounded by it. And it's quite variable in terms of the species that you're dealing with. So, for example, some of the marine species like the ray and the skate, they have a huge amount of ammonia in their bodies, and it can be really, really a very, very strong smell. So very often those fish are bled before the fish then is taken on shore and used then for human consumption.
Well, needless to say, Ken, I'm asking you for a reason, because apparently there's a mutation in a particular gene that we humans carry around with us that makes that smell, if we have this mutation, that nasty, awful, horrible smell of fish seem less intense. A study, which is the largest genome-wide association study, or GWAS, of olfactory genes in humans involving a sniff test, looked at over 9,000 people from Iceland, and it also showed that people vary in their ability to discern the smell of licorice and cinnamon. I love the smell of cinnamon, I have to say, but I do not like the smell of fish. I really cannot stand it. But at any rate, to tell us more about it is linguist Dr. Rossa Gísladóttir of Decode Genetics in Reykjavik. Hello, Rossa. You're very welcome to the programme. Tell us about your study.
Well, this study is actually a part of a bigger project on human diversity in general. So we're interested in all kinds of phenotypes or behaviours, cognition, voice, smell, etc. I kind of volunteered to work on this sub-project on smell because it's a fascinating domain for many reasons. One is that the smell genes or olfactory genes are kind of a weird class in humans. They've been mutated a lot. There's a lot of sequence variants in them. And so one question is, okay, what is the sequence diversity doing? Is it actually giving us more sensitive smell or gradually losing our sense of smell in some sense? People take part in this task, which is basically sniffing these odor pens, and we were using 6 odor pens, so it's not like a comprehensive study of all kinds of odor molecules or something like that, but these 6 odor pens, and people are asked to rate them in terms of intensity, how strong they think the odor is, and pleasantness, and then we ask them to say what it is. What is the smell? Mm-hmm. And that is a variable that is also very interesting, a lot of work on odor naming in cognitive science and linguistics, for instance.
So which odors were you exposing people to?
We used fish, licorice, cinnamon, banana, peppermint, and lemon. And some of these are actually blends, but the ones that we discovered genetic variants in genes that have to do with fish, cinnamon, and licorice odors.
Now, as I've said, I really detest the smell of fish. Am I unusual?
Well, that's a very common response, and probably we evolved to have this response. So this gene that we found a variant in that influences our perception of fish, this TAR5 gene, is very conserved between species. It's probably very important for detecting this foul smell, which is actually not just kind of fishy in fish, it's also in animal odors, feces, blood, sweat, etc. It's probably quite important for us to be able to detect this smell, so it's a natural response. And this variant that we discovered, it was kind of by luck that we did this research in Iceland, because it happens that this variant is most frequent in Iceland. About 4% of Icelanders carry this variant. So the remainder of the population definitely has a very strong response to fish odor.
Why would we evolve this sensitivity?
That's the idea that it helps us, kind of protects us from bad pathogenic microorganisms in spoiled food, for instance. So rotten fish or rotten animal odors, etc. So the idea is that this protects us from something bad.
Well, now that's a very interesting observation. Something comes to mind. Jack Spratt would eat no fat. His wife would eat no lean. And they kept the platters clean. Now, is there an element here of getting some people to eat certain things? I mean, after all, smell, it draws you to food and repels you from what you don't like. Mm-hmm. Is there a mechanism here to ensure the wider use of food resources by bringing people towards some and ensuring that others go elsewhere? Like curlews have long bills. The long bill of the female is longer than the male. So do you think there's some element of that, a selection going on? It's extraordinary that different variants would survive if they weren't valuable.
Well, clearly odors and our sense of odors matters for perception of flavor, that's certainly something that we have to keep in mind, that maybe if you have certain variants, you're more likely to eat certain foods or enjoy them more, etc., or find them not as pleasant and avoid them, etc. Kind of depends on the region and what kind of foods are common or popular or whatever. Maybe we are adjusting to those regional diets in a way, and that's one idea behind this TAR5 variant that we discovered. Maybe it's most frequent in Iceland exactly because this horribly bad fish smell is actually quite common in the diet, because it exists in dried fish and in skate, which is eaten around Christmas, etc. So maybe actually in that case, being able to eat more of those foods with that odor was actually helpful.
You probably needed to be able to smell it in order to find it. Don't you bury fish and shark for long periods of time in Iceland to get you through the winter, or traditionally at any rate?
Traditionally, yes. So rotten shark and fermented skate were actually quite important during the Middle Ages, an important part of the diet. One reason being that we didn't have access to salt to preserve the food and using other ways. Same with dried fish, which actually people use to eat just like bread with butter on it. And dried fish is actually very common still today in the diet. And that has a little bit of that odor, the trimethylamine odor that TAR5 is detecting. So it's not as obnoxious, but it's in the diet.
Rosa, I was fascinated by the fact that your research has taken us to an area where we now know that there are something like 850 olfactory genes that we have as humans, but that only about 400 of these are actually activated. Mm-hmm. In my fishy world, we've been looking at a phenomenon called switch genes. And what we have found is you might think that those particular genes that haven't been switched on or aren't switched on at the moment, that in some way they're remnants, that they're just gone. But that isn't the case in many situations. They're just switched off. And it adds really to what you were saying about the evolution of this particular phenomenon. Because when you think about it, when the Vikings were raiding Ireland and bringing all of our lovely ladies up to Iceland and bringing all the hordes up to Iceland, they must have been very dependent on fish. And it would have been counterproductive, I think, for them at that stage to be in any way put off by fish in any sort of condition. But probably as the population has evolved, those particular genes have actually been switched off. But there may actually be advantages there in that in the future, it may very well be useful for other reasons that we haven't even thought of yet. There may very well be a situation where some of those genes can be switched back on again. So it's a very interesting phenomenon that over half of the genome would be switched off. I find that fascinating.
And that was one of the research questions. Okay, given that mutations have rendered half of our olfactory genes inactive, what are the mutations in the rest of our active genes then doing? Are they decreasing our sense of smell or not? And that was one of the main findings, is that we discovered these two variants associated with licorice and cinnamon odors, where people actually find these odors more intense, and in the case of licorice, more pleasant. And these are derived variants, so they are not in our ancestors. So it suggests that there's something in our environment that made us evolve or made the frequency of these variants higher in certain areas, at least.
I find this really fascinating because, of course, when we're talking about smell, in many ways, we're also talking about what we often think of as taste or flavor, because it's our olfactory sensors that get many of these in food, not the taste buds on our tongues. When I think of foods in Iceland and also in Scandinavian countries, licorice is a very interesting one, because I like licorice, but I certainly don't like licorice as strong as you do in Iceland, or as people do, let's say, in Denmark or Norway or Sweden. I'm wondering if that sort of genetic aspect of that, if there's a Viking element to that, or if it's because you're exposed so much more to licorice than we are, that it has somehow triggered something to turn on this gene.
It's a little bit confusing, because that was also something that we thought, wait a minute, maybe is this variant more common in Scandinavia, for instance? But that's actually not what we found. We found that the variant is most common in East Asia. But we should keep in mind that this ingredient that we were investigating, it's called trans-anethol, and it's found in all kinds of licorice-y products, also in star anise aniseed. It's in the diet, but just not as liquors, but as some herbs or spices. So we don't really know why Scandinavians love liquor so much. So that doesn't really fit the story, but it's interesting.
I know that one of my least favourite foods is coriander. I absolutely cannot stand the taste of it. And I know quite a few people are like that. Some people adore it and think it tastes very fresh and apparently quite citrusy. To me, it tastes like a bar of rotten soap. It's disgusting. And it's another genetic component to that. Another one that's quite famous, I think, is cucumber. Now, I quite enjoy the taste of cucumber. It doesn't taste like very much to me. But some people tell me it tastes like grass clippings. It tastes absolutely disgusting. And they can't understand how anybody could stomach it. I think these are very interesting genetic variants in humans that make one food very palatable and to other people very, very distasteful. Now, as mammals, of course, we humans have a very poor sense of smell and therefore of flavour detection. I'm wondering if it's be an advantage for us to lose our sense of smell in this regard so that we're actually able to find more food, different types of food palatable and eat a wider diet.
Well, I think the people who are suffering from COVID-19 who have lost their sense of smell would disagree with you. But anyway, go ahead, Rosa.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the case of COVID, for instance, that seems to be like a very extreme problem with smell. I imagine that that's not a very pleasant situation. But actually, that's an interesting idea that maybe maybe it was helpful to lose some of those genes and that then we would be able to eat different foods. I don't know. That's a plausible explanation.
As we've got birdy and fishy people here, I'll start with you, Ken, and then I'll come back to you, Niall. Ken, I was mentioning that I don't like the smell of fish generally, and I don't eat very much fish. I'm just wondering, can fish smell fish?
Well, an interesting angle is that fish can certainly, in my view, at least some of them can smell humans. I've had a very interesting experience while fishing in New Zealand, where when I started to fish there, I used to wear all sorts of boots and waders and so on, and it got too warm. And over there, they have a great habit of doing what they call wet wading, basically wading into the river with very light clothing on, either shorts or light trousers, just wear the wading boots. And one of my friends, the first time I was there, said to me, "You do realise that when you do that, you disturb all the fish in the pools downstream." And I thought this was ridiculous. I mean, I never heard such nonsense. So the second year I was there, I had some reason to start doubting myself. So what I did was I got my friend David to wade in and out several pools above where I was and to watch exactly in the clear water what was happening. And it was quite extraordinary how the fish reacted, because they certainly got very uncomfortable as the water that had been around his knees and around his shins and so on, as it reached the pool, they became very twitchy and they became very nervous and they moved out of the lies where they were feeding. And it took maybe 15, 20 minutes for them to settle down again. So there was no doubt about it. They may do this with a lot of other animals as well. But certainly they were very sensitive to these changes. As we know, they have a great sense of smell in terms of their ability to use that to home and so on. So they're obviously offended by different smells that are in the water. And you'd never think of that.
Explain that, exactly what you mean by that. You're talking about salmon finding their way back to the river in which they respond, that they can taste almost and smell the water, the river from which they came. Is that correct?
Yeah, and indeed, it's lots of other fish can do exactly the same. I mean, even fish we would see as very, very much sedentary fish like the bream that we have in Ireland, they can actually smell or taste their way back to their spawning grounds. Trout that are in rivers can very often smell or taste their way back to the area they came from. So they have a really strong sense of smell, and the ultimate sense of smell are in sharks. Sharks can actually taste or smell just molecules of food quite a distance away, and they can travel very long distances to corner out and to feed on the food. So that particular ability to be able to utilise the smell either for flight or indeed for feeding is very important to animals.
And the thing I was going to ask you now, considering so many marine birds feed on fish, can they smell fish? Do birds have a sense of smell?
Well, so to answer the second question first, do birds have a sense of smell?
Yes.
Most birds have a very poor or almost no sense of smell whatsoever. So the robin or the blackbird in your garden, they can't smell anything as far as we can tell. There's only two groups of birds which do have a good defined sense of smell. One is the group of vultures that occur in the Americas. So there's two types of vulture. There's ones that are found in the Old World and ones in the New World. The Old World vultures find they scavenge for their carrion by sight. But the New World vultures, they can detect it by the smell of rotten meat. So they're very good at detecting that. And I know that in the United States and in Canada, some gas companies there put the smell of rotting meat into the gas so that they can see if there's a leak somewhere in a remote area, they'll see vultures circling above it because they can detect the smell.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, so we have a bad smell in gas, so we can detect when the gas is leaking.
Exactly, because it's odorless normally, so that's to warn us as well. So that's the way they detect leaks there. But groups of seabirds, particularly the tube noses, so they're the albatrosses, the fulmars we were talking about in the programme recently, the shearwaters, the petrels, the storm petrels, they have a very well-developed sense of smell, and they have probably the best sense of smell of any bird. And what they do is they use that to detect food, and they can detect molecules of rotten or dead fish or even gases emitted by plankton from a very long distance away. So one of the things that that birdwatchers often do is go on what we call pelagic birdwatching trips. So you go out into the deep ocean on a boat, and then stuff called chum is thrown over the side. And this is fish blood and fish guts and rotting fish.
Yeah.
It's horrible smell. And when you're combined with seasickness, it's not the most pleasant experience when you're on a boat as a human. But it's amazing. You will see, as soon as that goes out of the boat, there'll be no birds around. And all of a sudden, within minutes or even seconds, birds like shearwaters and particularly storm petrels just appear out of nowhere. So they're smelling that from quite a long distance. And it's been carried on the wind. It was interesting to hear Ken talking there about fish using the sense of smell to migrate or for homing instincts, because of course birds are famously migrate and have homing abilities as well, but they seem to do it in a very different way. They don't do it through smell, except for some of the seabirds may perhaps do that. Birds do that by being able to, it seems, sense the magnetic field of the Earth. They're also able to detect changes in gravity on the Earth, which give them an idea of where they are on the planet. Some of them seem to use star maps to be able to navigate where they are in the world and to get back. So they seem to do it in a much more visual way, but also using senses that that we can't even think of, like sensing magnetic field. But it seems that apart from certain seabirds, scent does not play a role in that for them. So it's interesting how two completely different systems have evolved in different vertebrate groups.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Rosa, thank you very much indeed for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Our pleasure. And look what conversation you stimulated. I have to say, I love coming in here to make this programme because you learn something new every day. Now, let's move on. It's that time of year again, autumn, the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness. And last week we discussed the changing colours of autumn with Dr. Matthew Jebb from the National Botanic Gardens. Well, an animal that's quite active at this time of year is the humble hedgehog. And inevitably, that means more texts and emails to the programme about this unusual mammal. So now, from his home in Dublin 15, we're joined by Terry Flanagan. Terry.
That's right, Derek. John Daly from Drumcondra has been in touch to say that over the summer he's had a hedgehog in his garden and that more recently a second one has also appeared. It's the first time that hedgehogs have visited his garden and he was intrigued by them and wanted to learn more about them. So before the latest COVID restrictions came into operation, I headed off to meet him.
Come on into the back garden here, Terry. I have something to show you.
My God, this is a fine big mature garden you have here, John.
Yeah, well, I look after it well. I'm a farmer's son, so I'm used to tilling the soil and I have nice flowers and all. But I have something very unusual I came across during the summer here, Terry.
Go on, tell us.
You wouldn't believe it. A hedgehog has been coming into my garden during the summer. Now, I haven't seen a hedgehog, I'd say, in the last 40 or 50 years. We had one in our garden at home in Kinnegad years ago, but I haven't seen one in Dublin since.
So you're here in Drumcondra.
That's right, yes.
It's fairly well built up.
Yeah, it's busy, but there's a park not too far away. I suspect maybe he would have come from there, but I don't know. But and what's more, there's a second one there, and it's smaller, and that looks like perhaps it's a baby hedgehog. I'm not sure.
So he's been coming into the garden, this first one?
Yeah, this first one's been coming in quite a bit. And
How is he getting in?
Well, come up this way and I'll show you a bit, Terry. Up here at the top of the garden, there's an opening. It's a bit of a timber fence, but they'd have no bother getting in under it.
Right.
So that's likely where they came, I'd say.
Okay, I can see it.
Just there now. Just there. Just be careful there, Terry, with the shovel. Yeah, that's grand. So I'd say they come in through that fence, I would imagine, anyway.
Okay. And you've now seen this second one.
Yes, and I'm just suspect it's smaller and delicate looking,
right.
And I suspect that it's a baby hedgehog.
Right.
I'm not sure. Don't ask me the sex. I don't know whether they're male or female, but I'd presume maybe some mother with a baby.
Right, okay. It's a bit late in the season for it.
Yes, I would have thought that myself. Mm. I thought they wouldn't be still around at this time of the year
October. It's not totally unusual, but I'd be more worried that it may not make it through the winter because, as you know, they hibernate for the winter.
And they're common in Ireland still, Terry, are they?
They are indeed. They're found in every county in Ireland.
Should I encourage them into the garden, or what should I do?
I definitely think you should, because they are the gardener's friend. Yeah. There's no two ways about it. They come in here, they eat slugs, they eat beetles, they eat all those kinds of pests. So if they come into the garden, they're going to do that job for you. Yes. So you're not going to have to put out pesticides or molluscicides or any of those chemicals in the garden.
Of course, when my wife sees them, Mary sees them, she's wondering, should we leave out food for them? What kind of food should we leave out for them?
Well, that's a really good question.
Yes, indeed, Terry, that's a really good question, and one that has cropped up on the programme many times.
Yes, and the answer is always the same. Don't leave out bread and milk for them. Last week, we were advising listeners not to feed the swans bread. But in the case of the hedgehogs, the problem is the milk.
Well, I have to admit, Terry, that I've left out bread and milk.
A lot of people do that, John. It's not ideal for them because milk is not very good for them. It runs through them. It gives them diarrhoea. There's lots of other foods that you can give instead of it. If it's a young hedgehog, what you can do, you can give it the bread, okay, but don't put milk on it. Put something like Bovril or soup or something like that. Crunch up maybe some biscuits. But ideally what you can give is dog food or cat food. Oh. Put out dog food or cat food and mush it up with water. Make it a mushy food for them. And they will thrive on that. And you will see them coming in and out of the garden all the time.
Great, because my son has three cats and he'd have no problem, Carl would have no problem feeding the hedgehogs with the cats.
Well, there's where you're going to get your cat food from. Anyway. You won't have to pay for that.
And do they become dependent then on the food that you give them?
The hedgehog is not just going to come to your garden. He's going to go to lots of other gardens because their territory is quite big. Right. Now, if you're leaving out food for them every night, then he's going to keep coming to your garden every night. And then he may stop going to the other gardens. So if you're not there some night, if you get sick or you go away on your holidays or that, then all of a sudden, the food that he was getting that he was dependent on, he's not getting it anymore. So what should you do? Should you leave out the food? Should you not leave out the food? Should you take a break? I would say certainly leave out the food. Yes. Because you're going to encourage him into the garden and he is going to eat those natural foods as well. So, yes, to answer your question, I would leave the food out.
And I would have thought by now, would they be hibernating, hedgehogs?
Yes, we're now into October. Towards the end of October or towards November is the time they go into hibernation. It's been pretty mild for the last couple of weeks or so. So maybe it'll be November. That little one that you mentioned earlier, I'd be a little bit worried about him. And what generally happens in a situation like that is you might have a rehabilitator would come and would catch the little baby one and weigh it. And the key weight is about 450 grams. Right. So if they hit 450 grams, they should be able to get through the winter. If they're less than 450 grams, what a rehabilitator would do is they take them in and they keep them in for the winter and then release them in the spring.
So it's just about a half a kilogram, really. Yeah. Quite light, isn't it?
It's quite light.
And are they good to have in the garden?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Really good to have in the garden. Good. Apart from being able to come out and look at them, I think they're a beautiful animal.
And a lovely creature,
lovely animal. Now, the Irish name, do you know the Irish name for it?
Yeah, my father, Lord of Mercy, Peter Daly, kindergarten, used to call them granyogs.
Granyogs, that's exactly the Irish name. Do you know what it means, granyog?
Well, the Irish word gran means ugly, am I right?
Correct.
Granyog, an ugly one or small ugly one.
But they're not ugly. I think
they're not. They're beautiful, creatures.
Yeah. And even the English name hedgehog, because hog is pig.
Yes.
Pigs grunt.
Right, that's right.
So in the evening time, I don't know whether you've seen or heard this, but you'd see them as they're going along in the hedgerows, the grunting as they're going through. So hedgerow, pigs, hedgehog.
Oh, that's where the name came from.
Yeah.
Isn't that extraordinary? Yes.
It's
hedgehog, yes. Yeah. Yes, I never had thought of that.
Yeah, well, there you are. Yeah. So, look, what I'd say to you is I would keep feeding.
And hopefully then they will hibernate eventually.
Yes, but I would keep an eye on that little one. Your job now is, John, you've got to fatten up that little hedgehog in the next couple of weeks.
With the proper food.
With the proper food so that he can get into hibernation. And you know what the proper food is?
I think I do, but you'll repeat it to me now again, Terry.
What it is not bread and milk.
That's what I know, yes. I know what it's not, but what is it?
Dog food.
Cat food. Very good.
Either of the two of them.
Yes.
Thank you, John, for the honesty, and thank you, Terry, for the report. That's all we have time for today. More thanks now to our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly, our broadcast coordinator, Anne-Marie Donlan. On sound, we had Ruth Kennington, and sitting in the producer's hot seat, Sheila O'Callaghan. Until next time, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.